Well, good morning, dear brethren and sisters. We'll open our meeting of remembrance this morning with the singing of hymn number 282. O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast, and our eternal home. Hymn 282. Before we give the word of exhortation, we'll sing together hymn number 288. Hymn 288. Loving Shepherd of thy sheep, keep thy lambs in safety, keep. Nothing can thy power withstand, none can pluck them from thine hand. Hymn 288.
Thank you.
Well, again, good morning, dear brethren and sisters. Our readings from Luke's Gospel yesterday and today give us much food for thought in our service before our Master, and we do well to ponder them. Luke 15 brings to our attention aspects of being lost and found, with an expose of two characteristics of personal behaviour, that of a prodigal or wasteful, extravagant squanderer, and thankless, proud self-righteousness. And today, chapter 16, we have read a third, that of dishonesty. The audience that gathered around Jesus in chapter 15, apart from his disciples, were the publicans and sinners who had an interest in what he had to say. The Pharisees and the scribes, whose main aim was to criticize and find fault, were also there. Their accusation against him was that he received sinners and ate with them. The three parables in chapter 15 particularly address this allegation and challenge and expose their hypocrisy. In the first two parables, the focus of attention is first on a shepherd who finds one of his 100 sheep has gone astray. And the second is on a woman who notices that one of her 10 coins has gone missing. The sheep possibly thinks it has gained some freedom, but in reality is vulnerable to attack from predatory animals or birds. The coin, however, is inanimate. It is therefore unaware of its value, or that it has gone astray. The shepherd and the woman, however, are conscious of their loss and take appropriate steps, searching diligently to find and to restore that which is lost. That the sheep and the coin are observed to have gone missing is evidence that previously they were not lost. The sheep had been with the other 99 in the fold, but had escaped. The coin was still in the house, but it was not in its rightful place with the other 9. Now, since the object of the parable was to demonstrate that there is joy in the presence of the angels of God in heaven over the sinner who repents, is evidence that the shepherd and the woman are both representative of the Lord Jesus, whose task it is to seek and to find. And those described as neighbours are the angels. While the parable was primarily a justification to the Pharisees for Jesus receiving publicans and sinners, it is also undoubtedly an exhortation to us to look out for and to note absentees and not neglect the responsibility we all have to make every effort to reclaim a lost brother or sister and rejoice when success is achieved. In using the example of the sheep, Jesus indicates the loss of one who leaves the flock or the fold. Their absence makes them easy to identify. We know them, we know who they were. But the coin indicates those who are lost within the household, and these may be more difficult to recognize and to find. So the parables complement each other in quite a remarkable manner. Jesus then brings these two aspects of being lost into one parable about the two sons, one lost away from home and the other lost staying at home. And he does so in a most exquisite and detailed manner. And who among us can claim not to contain portions of the two personalities described? It has to be said that in order to bring out the spiritual lessons, Jesus had to frame certain details of the story in a manner not quite true to life. For example, how many parents would be willing to divide and part with a portion of an inheritance long before any sign of personal decay, and doing it knowing the disposition of the individual concerned. And with such an outcome, how many fathers would be continually on the lookout for the prodigal's return, run to meet him and receive him with such emotion? But this is not a parable about a human father, but about a compassionate and gracious God. And it is the example he gives to us as human fathers. If his audience did but know it, Jesus may have had in mind a portion of the prophecy of Jeremiah. It's chapter 31. So let us look what the prophet Jeremiah had to say. Jeremiah 31. And we read from verse 15. Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rahel weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children, because they were not. Thus saith the Lord, refrain thy voice from weeping, and thine eyes from tears, for thy work shall be rewarded, saith the Lord. And they shall come again from the land of the enemy. And there is hope in thine end, saith the Lord, that thy children shall come again to their own border. I have surely heard Ephraim bemoaning himself thus, thou hast chastised me, and I was chastised, as a bullock unaccustomed to the yoke. Now, as a bullock or a yoke or a horse needs to be broken in before it can be usefully employed, so Jeremiah portrays Ephraim coming to terms with God's discipline. So we continue, turn thou me, and I shall be turned, for thou art the Lord my God. Surely after that I was turned, I repented, and after that I was instructed. I smote upon my thigh, a sign of sorrow. I was ashamed, yea, even confounded, because I did bear the reproach of my youth. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he a pleasant child? For since I spake against him, I do earnestly remember him still. Therefore my bowels are troubled for him. I will surely have mercy upon him, saith the Lord. Set thee up waymarks, make thee high heaps. Set thine heart toward the highway, even the way which thou wentest. Turn again, O Virgin of Israel. Turn again to these thy cities. How long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth. A woman shall compass a man. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, as yet they shall use this speech in the land of Judah and in the cities thereof, when I shall bring again their captivity. The Lord bless thee, O habitation of justice and mountain of holiness, and there shall dwell in Judah itself, and in all the cities thereof together, husbandmen and they that go forth with flocks. For I have satiated the weary soul, and I have replenished every sorrowful soul. Upon this I awaked and beheld, and my sleep was sweet unto me. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And it shall come to pass that like as I have watched over them, to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so will I watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. This is, of course, a prophecy of the restoration of Israel and Judah in the future, but it fits with the message Jesus here presents to his audience. We must, of course, not forget that the parable continues the theme of lost and found, And the target of his discourse is the Pharisees. The examples Jesus uses here are brothers, sons of the same father. It did cross my mind that in view of the elder brother's refusal to acknowledge his sibling, they could have had different mothers, but it does not add to the story. The summary of the younger son's activity was that he wasted his substance with riotous living. In terms of pleasure and acceptable service to his father and eternal salvation, his chosen lifestyle was a complete waste. It took the complete loss of all that he thought dear and a severe famine with intense hunger to bring him to his senses and to consider the benefits of the security that working for his father could offer. And there are lessons in this for us all. Gone were all thoughts of the excitement and adventure he sought when he left home. Gone were the complaints against the civil duties of domestic and ecclesiastical responsibilities associated with providing for the family. Was his recollection of his father that of the servant given the one talent? Matthew 25, verse 24. Then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. Is that why he left home? To escape his perception of an overbearing father? The description of the younger son had not been flattering, and we wonder whether the tax collectors and sinners recognized how Jesus was describing them. Some may have been offended, but the story was not directed at them. Jesus makes no mention of the journey home, but we can imagine that the prodigal had plenty of time to consider his past behavior and his doubtful future, and also to rehearse the appeal he planned to make before his father. And there is here an echo in Psalm 119. Psalm 119, verse 59. I thought on my ways and turned my feet unto thy testimonies. I made haste and delayed not to keep thy commandments. Never in his wildest dreams did that son imagine the reception he would experience as he approached the familiar surroundings of home. The sharp-eyed father had seen him a long way off, and overjoyed at his return was already on his way to extend a welcome fit for a prince. With no opportunity to complete that appeal he had so diligently practiced, he found himself surrounded by a love he could not begin to comprehend. And our thoughts go to Psalm 103 as we contemplate this moment of rejoicing. Psalm 103, verse 8. The Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger and plenteous in mercy. He will not always chide, neither will he keep his anger forever. He hath not dealt with us after our sins, nor rewarded us according to our iniquities. For as the heaven is high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward them that fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions from us. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. For he knoweth our frame, and he remembereth that we are dust. Psalm 32, verse 5. I acknowledge my sin unto thee, and mine iniquity have I not hid. I said, I will confess my transgressions unto the Lord, and thou forgavest me the iniquity of my sin. Before he knew it, a robe for his body, a ring for his finger, and shoes for his feet were placed upon him. The scriptures abound with examples of clothing and being clothed. from the coats of skin prepared by God for Adam and Eve, the coat worn by Joseph so enraged his brothers in the book of Genesis, to the garments of white linen worn by the saints in the book of Revelation. So we understand the implication of what is happening, and we contemplate the words of the prophet Isaiah 64, verse 6. But we are all as an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags, and we do fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. Prophet Zechariah also made reference to the same symbology, chapter 3 and verse 3. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. To give a ring was a mark of honour and dignity, and we find an example in Genesis 41. To show his gratitude and respect, Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in a vesture of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck. Both sandals and ring are marks of the free man, as slaves were barefooted. Servants probably did not usually wear shoes. The son returned, doubtless without shoes. When therefore the father gave the instruction to put shoes on him, it expressed his wish that he should not be treated as a servant, but as a son. The word shoes here, however, means no more than sandals, such as were commonly worn. And the meaning of all these images is the same, that God will treat those who return to him with kindness and affection. Thus we have a threefold symbol of freedom and honour extended to the penitent son as the fruit of perfect reconciliation. Finally, the command came to treat the son as a guest of honour. Bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. The slaying of the fatted calf for the feast of rejoicing was an outstanding token of intense religious thankfulness at the prodigal's return. For the word used here means to kill for sacrifice. So this great celebration centered around a peace offering which outstandingly emphasized the renewal of fellowship together before God, not unlike the sacrifice we come to remember this morning. But all was not well. The elder son was where he considered he was supposed to be, working in his father's fields, and at the end of the day, on returning to the house, heard the sound of celebration and partying. But instead of going in to assess the situation for himself, to obtain the truth, allowed his suspicions to dominate his thoughts. He sought his information by approaching the servants to find out what was going on. Does that sound familiar? Instead of accepting what his father had done was bound to be right, made inquiries of others, who, perhaps knowing some of the facts, presented them without the emotional substance that was essential, leaving him to develop his suspicions and prejudices in a most unhealthy manner. How well did Jesus know the hearts of mankind and the scribes and the Pharisees, who were the particular target of this part of the story? Sadly, his focus, the focus of the elder son, was on what he had done and what he had achieved. It was a totally selfish assessment. He was lost. Truly lost in his own world and the things he considered important, and was not prepared to even consider that which had prompted his brother and caused him to return. This selfish, prejudiced attitude spilled out again as he protested to his father that despite his fulfilling of all duties and responsibilities, he had been offered no opportunity to celebrate with his friends. Here was pride expressed completely. And well did Jesus present another parable in Luke chapter 18 regarding the Pharisee who boasted of all his supposed righteous acts. And the publican who could but beat upon his breast begging for mercy. Did he know his father? Did he want to know his father? Did he really appreciate what his father really wanted from him? He could have asked himself what special deed or act he could perform that would have caused his father to rejoice. The negative answers to these questions demonstrate how desperately lost this son was and all whom he represents. Now it was the father's turn, and we marvel at the contrast. Son, he said gently and with affection, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was meet that we should make merry and be glad. This was not recompense for the prodigal for his evil life, as the brother had so unkindly and unjustly implied, but an overflow of irrepressible joy. The reason for this, thy brother was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And here Jesus stops the parable. But is it the end of the matter? Surely there is still time for the elder brother and all whom he represents to respond positively to the father's appeal on behalf of the prodigal, whoever he or she might be. Two lessons come clear. The first is for parents and concerns the teaching the father gave to his sons in their childhood, for it provided for them with the foundation for the knowledge in their hearts of who they were and where their destiny lay. The prodigal knew his father. The second is for us all, that whatever our experience or prejudice regarding an individual, we must be ready to welcome the repentant offender. Two things we must not do. One is to usurp the responsibility and authority of the Father in our dealings with one another by writing them off and refuse to cooperate. And the other is to add to the parable. The prodigal's offence was against the father, not his brother. Offences against others, offences against our brother, is catered for in Matthew chapter 18. So now we come to the parable we read this morning, and I think I'm correct in saying that it is perhaps the most perplexing of parables because it appears to present Jesus as recommending what appears to be dishonesty. We refer, of course, to the parable of the unjust steward. The three parables we have considered so far were spoken for the benefit of the publicans and the sinners, and for the Pharisees who came to listen. Jesus now turns to address his disciples for their warning and for their instruction. The story of the steward and its application to the Pharisees was to be a warning to them for the days when they would find themselves in positions of authority in his ecclesias as God's steward, with the responsibility of upholding and administering faithfully the principles of his teaching, a position passed on that we must, in our day, must not neglect. The rich man, we can be sure, is God himself. The steward, who had neither stolen nor hoarded his master's goods, or nor even given them away, but merely wasted them, represents the Pharisees and lawyers, who, by virtue of their religious and social standing, had become ministers or stewards of God's law to the rest of the nation. But what had they done? Perhaps we can best consider this by looking first at the lesson Jesus was putting to his disciples. Certainly, it was a lesson in integrity. Verse 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? No servant. Now let's underline that word, servant, because that is what the steward and what he represents is, and that can be us. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. The repetition of the word mammon has misled many into thinking that Jesus was talking about the wise use of money, whereas in fact he was alluding back to the parable in verses 5 to 7 and what the steward's mammon stood for. Jesus was not so much concerned with prudence in financial matters, but with overall faithful service. Now let's consider Jesus' parable of the talents in Matthew 25. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. To every man, and note this, according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. In this parable, the master commended the servants for their faithfulness, for using their full potential in making a return to the master, according to their ability. But what does the unjust steward do? Verse 5. So he called every one of his lord's debtors unto him, and said unto the first, How much owest thou unto my lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, Take thy bill, and sit down quickly, and write 50. Then said he to another, And how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, Take thy bill and write 40. What the steward was doing here was to reduce the debt owed to the rich man, even to God. And he gave an example of the way the Pharisees and scribes had reduced the debt in verse 18 by relaxing marriage laws. Jesus reminded them what the law really taught. Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery. And whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery. But this was not the only example of the way the lawyers and the Pharisees altered the debt. Jesus added to this list in Mark chapter 7. He answered and said unto them, Well hath Isaiah prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, This people honoureth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandments of God, ye hold to the tradition of men, as the washing of pots and cups, and many other such like things ye do. And he said unto them, Full well ye reject the commandment of God, that ye may keep your own tradition. For Moses said, Honour thy father and thy mother, and whoso curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, If a man shall say to his father or mother, It is Corban, that is to say, a gift by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. and ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or mother, making the word of none effect through your tradition which ye have delivered, and many such like things ye do." In many ways, they were making religion more palatable. Does that sound familiar? So how should we understand verse 9 and the strange-sounding recommendation? Luke 16, verse 9, "And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations." Now let's have a look at that little word "of." Make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. Because in this instance, there is a Strong's and a Thayer's concordance reference to it. Now, it's such a little word that you would hardly think of looking in a concordance for a definition of the word "of." But this particular one, the Greek word is "ek," and this word may be translated "away from." We also understand that in Anglo-Saxon, this word "of" also had the meaning "away from." If this is the case, and we suggest that it is, then Jesus is saying that we should make our friends away from. Indeed, as far as possible away from the mammon of unrighteousness. Here is another little word, "ye." When ye fail. In several translations, this word is remembered, "it fails." So mammon certainly will fail. The last word is "habitations." Both Strong and Thayer suggest tent or tabernacle. So verse 9 may now read, "And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends away from the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, and the mammon of unrighteousness will fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations or tabernacle with God." We have considered facets of being lost and the joy of being found. We have also considered our faithful service to God and the Lord Jesus, whom we have come together this morning to remember. And we conclude our thoughts with a reference to Revelation chapter 21 from verse 1. "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away." We have chosen as our memorial hymn, hymn number 263, hymn 263. "We come, O Lord, our Saviour, to lift our hearts to Thee, to praise Thee, and remember Thy love, so great, so free. Thy life for us Thou gavest, Good Shepherd of the sheep. From death's dark veil Thou savest, Lord, in Thy love us keep." Hymn 263. I've asked our brother John Hitches to close with a word of prayer after we have sung together hymn number 215. Hymn number 215. To God be the glory, great things he has done. So loved he the world that he gave us his Son, who yielded his life, an atonement for sin, and opened the holiest that all may go in. Number 215.